This is the March 1st, 2018 statutory interpretation class, and we are beginning with our last day of discussion of statutory interpretive theory before we turn to the actual mechanics and implementation of statutory interpretation. And as a result, as always, let's start with a very quick look back. We talked about on Tuesday, oh so long ago, 48 hours, I know I feel bad about reminding you of things that are still fresh in your memory, but we talked about two cases. Now, I didn't assign those two cases because I wanted you to know about the vagaries of civil rights law or the Voting Rights Act or what happens when you want to get experts' fees in cases. These two cases are bookends. They are marvelous illustrations on how more purpose-driven interpretation is set up side by side with new textualist approaches and how they interact and deal with the same source material to reach very different conclusions. To make it even more stark, both of these opinions have the two principal authors, but in reverse roles. Remember, for our first case, Chisholm, we had Scalia writing the majority, with Stevens writing the dissent. And then, with West Virginia University, we had the reverse. Wow. When we went through that, remember what the issue of the case was for the first one with Chisholm. The focus is on whether or not judges were going to be subject to the Voting Rights Act procedural requirements. And to reach the answer that they weren't, Stevens focused on beginning the words at a very low, specific, fine, granular level. In particular, he focused on the word "the," as in the vote, to imply that there is a unitary, single, protected right. Then he focused on the word "and," to point out that there is a right to be protected to participate in the voting process itself. They can't lock the doors of the polling place to you. But even if they let you in to vote, that vote has to mean something. It has to result in you electing the representative of your choice. And there's where we get to the rub of the nub. We're talking about what does representative mean? Now, from his perspective, he took essentially a purpose-driven functional approach to the statute. What he was looking at was whether or not this interpretation would result in a more protective interpretation that would promote the voting rights the statute was supposed to insulate, to promote. So from that perspective, he looked at not only the words, but he looked at the fact of how it actually impacted the elections. And then he looked at the statutory history that led to its creation. And there, it was the fact that the language that was used in the statute intentionally swapped out the word in the original versions of the Supreme Court opinion that used the word legislator to say representative, and that reflected a choice to broaden it. He also said it was illogical to separate the two rights, to participate and the right to actually elect someone, and treat them as if they're different because they're really part of the same integrated and voting process. Scalia, on the other hand, and this is where it's important from the new textualist perspective, offers one of his clearest formulations of how he interprets statutes, which is, look at the words. Number one, what is the ordinary meaning of the words? That's a very careful formulation. He didn't say plain meaning. He didn't say obvious. He said, what is the ordinary meaning of the words? And once you have that interpretation in hand, you hold that ordinary interpretation, or interpretation of ordinary words, against a background of canons of construction and presumptions of regularity and coherence and the overall structure of the statute. And if it doesn't create any dissonance, if the words still function, you stick with that original reading and stop. Don't look at legislative history. Don't look at historical context. Don't look at other factors. The words of the law are the law. And from that perspective, from his perspective, there's no ambiguity here. The provisions of 2A and 2B are crystal clear. And then after that point, he talked a little bit about some of the background in terms of whether or not a judge is a representative, remember the word representative? Which he looks at what the ordinary meaning of the word representative is. He then looked at whether or not there were some factors there involved with silence, the dogs that didn't bark. From his perspective, you cannot ascribe specific legislative intent to a failure to mention a topic in legislative history. And it was one of his first and earliest instances to reject the sleeping dogs doctrine. I only flagged that for you, not because it's a major point of the case, but because it comes back in a major way later with new doctrines that we'll talk about later in the semester dealing with whether or not congressional failure to mention an important point reflects a actual intention of Congress not to include something within the statute. And then last, he offered his own sort of pragmatic, bottom line, real world gloss on it, which is, it's not as if this interpretation had the illogical result of leaving judges' elections totally unprotected. We still had the constitutional base protecting a specific intent. So there you see, radically different results, same statutory textual material, one looking to the larger context and purpose of the statute, the other one sticking strictly to the black letter of the law as much as possible. All clear so far, because now we're going to rotate the mirror. West Virginia University, we have Scalia writing, and we have Stevens objecting and dissenting. And in this one, Scalia once again looks to the letters of the law. And what does he do here? Well, to a certain extent, he looks at the word attorney's fee and says, what does that mean? And does the fact that Congress did not say and expert fees make any difference? Is that a little bit like the dog that didn't bark a bit? To find the meaning of that, he looked to 40 other statutes in the U.S. Code to see how Congress in other contexts had used the words attorney's fees and when it had included expert fees and when it didn't. And said that that showed Congress clearly had the capacity, the ability, the willingness to draw in experts explicitly when it chose to. And as a result, while he's looking to the black letters of the skin of the words of the statute, he's also casting a very broad net to cover everything else in the U.S. Code that he could possibly find that mentions the word attorney's fees. So I'll pause there. Any questions about that aspect of it so far? Okay. Then Stevens, by contrast, essentially said, interestingly enough, don't look to other statutes. Look to the words of this particular statute. More importantly, look to what this statute is supposed to accomplish, which was here to enable private parties to bring lawsuits to defend their rights. And here, that lawsuit would protect their right to get full reimbursement of their health care expenses. This is a Medicaid reimbursement case. So given that background, given that context, he said that the logical interpretation is to focus on the reading of the words of just that statute and see how it works in that context. And don't worry. Don't necessarily have to engage with every other statute over the broad history of time that deals with the different subject matters. Now, a couple of thoughts here and sort of takeaways. What do you get out of this comparison? Number one, and this is one I've actually had a conversation with a couple of you about, yes, there's perhaps some inconsistencies in the way Scalia is approaching these two cases. And I'll just pause here. Hopefully I'm not shocking anyone by saying that. Okay, good. I'm taking silence here to say, well, of course, we all saw that. What does that mean? It simply means I'll suggest to you, please don't make the mistake of equating Scalia with new textualism. Scalia is a man. He was on the bench for many decades, and his views evolved and were implemented in varying cases, in a way that he acknowledged sometimes might appear inconsistent. When I talk about new textualism, Scalia offers the best examples of it. He's his most energetic champion. But that does not mean that anything he says is new textualism and vice versa. The textualism philosophy espoused stands apart from him. So, with that in mind, we'll talk a little bit towards the end of class about what those key dividing elements are of new textualism so you can hold on to what the core of it is, even as you're reading opinions that may seem to contradict a little bit. Other more minor things. Notice both decisions invoke dictionaries. Remember, this class is not about voting rights. This class is not about attorney's fees. This class is about how to interpret statutes. Ignore, when you read these cases, the substantive outcome. Sometimes you just want to look as to how they got those outcomes and what tools the justices and judges used. And here, dictionaries are enormously important if you're going to go with what the ordinary meaning of words are. Number two, notice this is one of the first indications of the doctrine we'll talk about later in the semester called the whole code canon. The whole code canon simply means that if you're interpreting a word, it is fair game to look outside the particular statute that you're looking at and see how that word's used in other statutes in the same code. built on the implicit assumption that Congress knowingly uses a word consistently. And therefore, you can draw fair inferences as to what that word means by looking to other statutes. All clear so far? Then let me leave you with a parting thought before we turn to our case for today, as well as a question which might help sharpen your thinking in all this. The parting thought is, Scalia may have won the battle. I think it's fair to say in some ways he lost the war, although in a larger sense he may still nonetheless have influenced the world geopolitical terrain. Namely, he may have won in these cases, but his approach, saying specifically, you shall not rely on legislative history, was actually rejected by every other justice in a later case. So he was never able to get every single justice to sign on board to that particular part of new textualism. I will pause here and say, it'd be interesting to watch how that evolves as the tenor of the Supreme Court changes with new appointees over the next 3 years, maybe 7 years. Going back to Huey's point. Number two, here's a question to sharpen your thinking. There is some discussion in those cases about what is ordinary meaning versus what is plain meaning. Now pause for a minute. Even if I just asked you cold on the street and offered you a shiner bot, you answered correctly. What is the difference between a plain meaning and an ordinary meaning? Why would Scalia emphasize that distinction?
I think it's described as ordinary meaning would be it's broader and more inclusive, and it's kind of just like what is the ordinary meaning to the average person, but then plain meaning can be different for any different subset of the population, like plain meaning of a word of art, a term of art for a member of that industry would be different than the ordinary
bless
meaning
you.
For everybody else.
Absolutely correct. Did y'all hear from this side? You're sometimes talks in a quiet voice.
Oh, I can say it again.
No, that's okay. Because I'm just going to essentially mangle what you said by restating it. The bottom line here is ordinary meaning is what it means to ordinary people. That sounds terrible the way I just said that. But the sense that there's a common shared meaning that the citizenry all participate in. If I literally walked down the street with a microphone and said, what do you think this word means? I should get a fairly general, consistent answer from the ordinary citizens on the street. The plain meaning is basically, what is something that doesn't have ambiguity? I can find a plain meaning in an incredibly abstract provision of the tax code dealing with what sort of dollars per ton I get for mining a particular kind of mineral. The meaning could be crystal clear and plain, but if I ask anyone in the street, their response is going to be, huh? So, does that make sense for everybody? Yes? Lacking in ambiguity, plain. And I agree, what's the distinction between plain and clear and lucid? Who knows? I shouldn't say it. I'm sure some people know, and we will talk about that in this class, but for now, I'm not going to agonize over the details here. Okay? Any other? Oh, I'm sorry.
Does plain incorporate context?
Of course. But usually, plain meaning is driven mostly by the additional text meaning itself, and context can usually buttress that plain meaning. So, if the text meaning and the context meaning overlap, it's easy to say it's plain.
Okay.
And by the way, I say you're sort of multi-sports today, it looks like. Well, that's true. Fair enough. No, it's on my mind because I'm actually getting my Astros tickets hopefully next week, so I'm thinking about this. Okay. Go Astros. All right. Okay. Any questions about those two cases and new textualism before we move on to our last and third school? Yeah, I'm sorry.
Sorry.
No. I was on a roll, which is a bad sign. What's up?
I just wanted to ask if you
take
language as a standard ordinary.
Well, remember, in that one, Scalia's writing a dissent.
Right.
And if you look at the first paragraph of the dissent, he, in one nice black-letter hornbook description, lays out how you should interpret a statute from his perspective. And he basically says, look to the ordinary meaning of the words, then hold it up against canons of construction and judicial precedents and other doctrines that provide context to the overall structure of the statute, And if the two match, you're done.
Okay.
All right. Does that make sense for everybody? All right. So now we're getting to our final next third doctrine, which is pragmatism. Now, I'm not asking you to volunteer for the case. I'm asking you to out a part of your history you may not want to share. But out of curiosity, how many philosophy majors are in the room? All right. Two? Anyone else? Just to give you guys cover, I was a philosophy major undergraduate. Got a UT plan too, is that okay? So I just may ask you guys, I know I'm asking you to condense literally over a century of philosophical discussion, but just off the top of your head, what is pragmatism?
I think it's a rejection of like the positivist view that there's some sort of meaning that's objectively available to everybody in the world that isn't incarnate.
That sounds like nihilism.
Well, no, I think pragmatism is more like saying maybe we have some sort of common understanding of what that means, but it's a process. It comes about through social interaction.
Okay, so there's no objective truth floating out there in some strange inaccessible dimension.
Or if there is, it's not accessible.
Okay, but bottom line is what matters is what works.
Right.
Back with it. Am I catching that correctly?
Oh, yeah, I was going to say that it's just a theory that focuses on practical.
So pragmatism is practicalism? I made up that word, don't worry. But.
I don't know. But yeah, it's the approaches you take to, I guess, in the context of like statutory orientation to resolve things that are
Okay, so you guys are describing an actual philosophical school that talks about to what extent pragmatic considerations matter more than conceptual philosophical notions of an abstract or absolute truth. And again, I don't mean to take your words and run with them. Does that sound right? So, larger, in an ordinary sense of the word, when I say someone's being pragmatic, what do you guys think of? And here, you don't have to be a philosophy major. Okay. When I say pragmatic, what's the core concept of the word that comes to your mind? Okay, so again, practical. Why? What does practical mean? I agree the two seem to correlate.
The more efficient, option.
Efficient? That's interesting. Okay. Yeah, by the way, I should warn you, you can clearly tell I'm picking on the margins today, which means you guys along the back row might start thinking here fairly soon. I like the raised eyebrow. That's very good. Okay. Here's the key thing. Notice what we've been talking about. The whole heart, stats, purpose-driven interpretation at heart is a very concept-driven approach, isn't it? The idea that there is something a statute should be addressing and that the court is an active partner finding out what that purpose is, and it basically is empowered to fill in gaps or interpret creatively a statute to accomplish that goal. Textualism, on the other hand, for deep conceptual reasons tied to democratic legitimacy and constitutional separation of powers and functional legislative drafting realities, says no, that you must stick to the text. But again, those are both very much driven by a set of axioms, principles. Pragmatism, and if I'm quoting correctly, doesn't rely on that. Pragmatism essentially doesn't make you look at a bench filled with options and say, I choose this one. It lets you pick all of them and mix and match as you choose to achieve a result that you think is the best result for that particular situation. So, with that in mind, I have to be honest with you. Pragmatism kind of sounds cool, doesn't it? Makes some sense. Kind of, you know, if you get wrapped around the axle arguing about philosophical abstractions or fine legal hairs, if you're a judge, pragmatism sort of says, let me just cut to the chase here. I'll do textualism here. I'll mix it in a little bit with some purposivism here. I might add a little bit of some spirit of the statute here, and we'll get to where we need to go. So this case is one of the leading examples of essentially a conflict between straight up textualism by Judge Easterbrook, who's one of the leading proponents of this, who actually is from the University of Chicago, which is why your comment about efficiency sort of made me go, whoa, interesting, because he's a big proponent of efficiency as a primary for interpretation, as opposed to Judge Posner, who is also very much from the school of efficiency, but here essentially made a big turn away from his prior writings. So with that in mind, I'm resisting the urge to go into the facts of this case because they're so ridiculously wonderful. But instead, I'm going to adhere to my promise and step back and let learned counsel advocate the case for the class at large. So with that in mind, counselor, I understand that you're representing the defendant in this case. Would you please state to the court the reasons why you think that his sentence is inappropriate?
So
I should have said, all of you are judges, so you're free to interrupt your oral argument with your questions if you'd like.
He sold over 100 grams of LSD, which triggers the 10-year sentence, which is triggered by the 10-year minimum sentence, which is triggered by 10 grams. But if you look at it, it was actually, if you take out the weight of the carrier, he only sold 670 milligrams, which wouldn't even trigger a 5-year.
So, counsel, to make sure I understand, carrier, what's the carrier here?
So, he was selling LSD, but it was dispersed in water vapor,
Okay. Which
weighs almost six times as much as the pure LSD.
Let me step out of character for a second. Just to make sure we're not generationally disconnected here, have you all seen water vapor? Do you know what it is? Picture it's something like onion skin paper. It's very, very thin. It's something you can almost use as tracing paper. And it is marvelously well suited for dipping into drinks if you have impregnated it with another substance. So, don't ask me how I know that. So, stepping back into character. So, I'm sorry, counselor. So, the carrier here is paper.
Yes, and the carrier could be anything. So, like you said, it could be liquid, it could be orange juice, it could be sometimes LSD is put into sugar cubes, which weigh a lot more than the LSD itself.
So why is that inappropriate, counsel?
Because if you look at the rest of the drugs in the statute,
So which statute are we talking about?
The Controlled Substances Penalties Amendment Act of 1990.
And I'm looking at the trial record. We are looking at page 410 on the trial record. Thank you.
So if you compare it to heroin or cocaine, there's a big difference between how much you have to sell to get the same, how many doses you would sell to get the same type of sentence.
Can you illustrate? I'm not sure I'm following you, counsel.
So if you look at 1A, 100 grams of heroin, it's equal to 100 grams of heroin is equal to 10,000 to 20,000 doses, and the cocaine would be equal to almost between 3,000 to 50,000 doses. But if you look at the LSD, it's only about 1,000 doses, would still trigger the 5-year minimum.
So, counsel, I'm still not sure I'm understanding why that's an issue. This Congress did not use the word dose.
They didn't, but if you look at it, it looks like Congress didn't understand how LSD is sold. In comparison to drugs that are sold by weight, LSD is not sold by weight, it's sold by dose.
So, are you arguing that this is a case of congressional incompetence?
Yes.
And that a congressional incompetence gives us bench of the Seventh Circuit the power to rewrite this statute to accomplish its purportedly true goals?
No, but we should look at it pragmatically and try to decide what Congress wanted and make sure that all of these are more equal in sentencing. And by taking make more sense.
I'm still not sure I'm following you, counselor. I mean, pragmatically, I'm curious, where does that end? If I were to say I can interpret a statute just because it's more pragmatic, i.e. more effective at some point, or more practical, this is the word I hear frequently, what can't I do? Suppose it was more pragmatic for me to say that LSD is actually equivalent to PCP in terms of size of dose and its virulence. Why can't we just simply say that B4 applies rather than B5?
I mean, you're going down a different train of thought, I guess. I think it's obviously Congress understood more how PCP is sold, which is why they divided it into two categories.
Counsel, I know I'm interrupting you, but that's what judges do. I'm curious, where in is your evidence that Congress did not understand what they were doing?
So if you look...
Is there anything in the trial record that shows Congress saying, oops, or any expert saying this is patently illogical, or anything from a pharmacist or chemist?
Yeah, there are some letters to Senator Joe Biden where it's talked about that it's unclear with respect to LSD whether the carrier was supposed to be considered packaging material or considered the mixture of the drug.
So a letter from a congressman in a subsequent Congress pertaining to legislation that is not this statute, which he himself admits will not pass the current Congress, should guide this court's interpretation.
Yes.
Stick to your guns, you got it.
Because it sort of shows what Congress is thinking and that they're also questioning this current statute. And so we should be questioning it as well.
All right, so is there anything else in the statute itself? You're talking to me, Frank Easterbrook, one of the leading textualists in the country. I want to see in the text something that supports this conclusion that you're asking us to draw based on abstract notions of justice and procurement.
Well, so it does say mixture, and I think it really depends on how you define mixture, whether a carrier is a mixture or a carrier.
Where is the word carrier in the statute?
There's not the word carrier.
Where's the definition of the word mixture in the statute?
There is no definition of the word mixture.
So where is your definition of mixture coming from, counsel?
The dictionary.
Which dictionary?
I'm not sure which one they use. A dictionary.
A dictionary. Does it matter which dictionary?
No, no.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Is there anything in the structure of the statute that is A to your cause? Okay. All right, then I'll pause here and say, you might want to save some time for rebuttal. I'm going to turn to counsel for the United States. So, counselor, explain to me why it is we're sending a man to prison for over 20 years, essentially based on the fact that his water paper weighs more than his drugs.
So I think the strongest argument is that since they made the distinction with the pure form of 100 grams or 1 kilogram of a mixture substance, they very easily could have done that for LSD, which shows that they're aware that there is a difference between cure and when there's a carrier. And then.
So the fact that there's a feature in another part of the statute that is lacking, silent in this provision, is enough for us to impute some congressional intent by the failure to. Keep going. I like that's a good textual argument of my brother and Judge Poster may disagree with.
And then there is no definition for mixture within the statute, but if you give it the ordinary meaning, you can't separate LSD from the paper once it's put in. And so that brings more to the ordinary meaning of mixture.
Counsel, if I take a water
with LSD in it, and I reimburse it in alcohol, the LSD comes back out again. It's not the same thing as being able to plug the brain off and piece of paper.
But I think you're saying that.
I mean, it's your reversibility in the heart of what a mixture is.
Yeah. So you can't, like, remove the LSD from the paper unless there's another.
So if I could remove it, that would change your argument.
Yeah. Like if it was just resting on top of it.
So if I mix grains of heroin with grains of salt, but I could still physically somehow separate the two, it's in your mind still a mixture or some part integrated whole?
Yeah.
Okay, and that's solely based on the fact that the PCB provision includes a statement here with a pure drug and the other provisions do not.
Yeah, and also for the LSD provision, it talks about containing a detectable amount of LSD, and so that detectable amount was the 6.7
milligrams. So if I take 1 milligram of LSD, and being a perverted soul, dissolve it into a bathtub filled with orange jello, and wallow it, and it's detectable. But nonetheless, the entire bathtub weighs 80 pounds, even though there's far less than the minimum trigger in the statute. In your mind, does that make me subject to potentially life in prison?
Yeah, I mean, based on the way it's written.
And
I
if
mean,
I...
not the bathtub, because that wouldn't be a mixture.
Well, I wouldn't include the bathtub in the way that I agree. And if I take pure, undiluted, absolutely pharmaceutical-grade LSD, but less than 10 milligrams, and I walk over to the nearest playground and offer it for 5 cents to a pre-kindergartner, that's totally fine in terms of drinking demand for drugs. Okay, I'm curious, counsel, I understand your reading of the statute is rigorous and written in the words. Explain to me what possible reasoning justifies the difference in those two conclusions, those two different effects scenarios. Is there any policy? Is there any rationale that would make sense to the man in the street?
No.
Setting out character. You're in good company. The Solicitor General could not come up with an explanation. Yes. So you're not alone. Don't go back. Back in her. Okay, keep going.
Yeah, I mean, I think if Congress wanted to account for the carrier, they would have written it the same way that they wrote.
Okay, so it's our job as judges to administer this statute, even if the results cannot be explained to an ordinary man in the street. Doesn't that immediately raise the possibility of maybe perhaps a constitutional violation here? How can you possibly have due process if you don't know what the law means?
I think you sort of said that the constitutional question deals more with invalidation than interpretation.
That sounds marvelous. What does that mean?
So I guess just you don't take that into account when you're interpreting
the test. Well, and here I'm cheating. Later in the semester, get out of character. We're going to talk about the canon of constitutional avoidance. That simply says when you're presented with an interpretation of the statute, I'm sorry, presented with a statute that has two interpretations, one of which raises serious constitutional concerns and one that doesn't, the court will choose the one that doesn't pose the constitutional concern. It's a prudential doctrine. It's a way of avoiding the fight you don't need to pick. It helps protect the integrity of statutes and doesn't raise unnecessary constitutional challenges. With that now in your back pocket, counsel, back to Baroner, I'm not sure I understand. You're advocating an interpretation statute based on the text, which if I were to ask someone in the street what sort of sentence makes sense for someone in our orange bathtub of jello, as opposed to someone giving LSD to pre-kindergartners, and you can't explain why one gets a lighter sentence than the other, how is that possibly going to comport with constitutional justice? And should we interpret the statute to avoid that? This is not a constitutional question. We're just trying to avoid the issue.
Well, I mean, not that LSD drug dealers would read this statute probably before, but I guess they could have been aware of that.
Okay. So I'm not sure, again, I'm understanding.
So, I mean, they had the notice, I guess, and they didn't have to put out the
notice. So they don't have to understand it. They just have to be able to read the statute and know if this is what it says. And that's enough. And it's a constitutional matter of mental process. We've satisfied that threshold.
Yeah.
Are you sure, guys? I'm sending a sense of lack of fervor for your argument at this point. Okay? Is there anything else you would add? Because so far, what I'm hearing you say is that because there's a distinction in terms of inclusion of one drug and the failure to include this drug, the structure of the statute, combined with just the black and white words of the statute, dictates that we have to send this poor schmo to prison for potentially the rest of his life because we're including the weight of the paper that he mixed his drug in rather than the drug itself.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Last chance before I turn back for any kind of rebuttal from your learned counsel to who's representing the defendant here. Okay, because you also realize I will be asking my fellow judges in the room to vote on your position here in a few minutes. So this is your best shot.
Well, I guess the last thing I would say is that you can't take into account she mentioned ongoing debates in Congress, and I don't think that should.
Okay. Any subsequent congressional activity is not relevant to interpreting the meaning of the words that were passed at the time. Fair enough. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Stepping out of character, the case doesn't talk about this, but I've also wondered. Congress actually used some pretty broad words here today. Any detectable? No. You know, we're talking nanograms, micrograms, attograms. Anything that can be picked up with any kind of advanced technology is enough to render the overall mixture. I mean, the fact that they could have said a threshold, where they could have said doses, indicates that Congress wanted to throw as broad a net as they could. So the text itself speaks to intent, and legislative history doesn't. So that's one possibility I might add on top of those. Yeah, but you're free to not do it or choose to. So, with that.
I think you brought up the fact that if someone sold LSD in its pure form, they might not even trigger this statute because of how light it is. And so it doesn't really make sense for Congress to try to get these lower level drug dealers who aren't selling many doses well. Someone who was selling 15 times the number of doses as Marshall wouldn't trigger the statute if it was with the pure form.
Okay. So what's the bite on that one? Why does that matter?
Once again, it just doesn't really make sense from Congress's point of view. Who are they trying to punish? Who are they trying to catch?
So this interpretation is spatially illogical given its own parameters and constructs.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else? I noticed you haven't mentioned at all whether or not judges have taken into account the norms of society and our general societal expectations in interpreting a statute. What's right? What's wrong?
I'm not sure where you got that from in the case.
My learned brother on the bench, Justice Posner, has raised this concern in prior oral arguments. I should also point out Judge Posner wrote the original U.S. versus Rose District Court opinion that would lead to the conviction and mandatory sentencing of your defendant under the harshest possible interpretation.
But even Judge Posner agrees that he didn't really, he disagrees with his previous opinion written.
Okay, at the risk of having Justice Posner, Judge Posner, should have been Justice Posner, but Judge Posner, interposing his actual thoughts on the matter, could you please recount what he said in his prior opinion?
In Rose?
No, I'm talking about speaking facetiously, speaking inaccurately in this opinion. I'm asking you to ask what he ruled in this case that you're currently arguing is an opinion and not an opinion. Anyway, keep going.
I mean, I would say that the sentencing guidelines where drugs that border in narrowly are sold by weight, this makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But for drugs
So what do you say makes sense? What does that mean?
It's not very equitable sense.
So sense includes equity, like in a legal sense. I should warn you, you're about to go down a rabbit hole of centuries of common law at this point.
He talks a lot about the irrationality of looking at LSD the same way we look at other drugs, like cocaine and heroin, that are
so equity, rationality, these are very legal concepts you're talking about. Anything else? Is it just, is it right? Is it moral?
Well, he says that it isn't because it's unequal treatment of people equally situated.
Okay. So unequal treatment, not in the constitutional sense. Just unequal in the sense that it violates our sense of what's right and what's wrong.
Yes.
And that a judge is allowed to take notions of that sort into account when they interpret the statute.
Well, legal cases, they are.
Okay. But your counsel for the defendant, what do you think?
I think that we should think about equal protection for people.
Okay.
And once again, Marshall did not sound that much else.
All right. So now, last step. I hear you, counsel. Judge Easterbrook may disagree. Judge Posner may be leaning over with an intent expression on his face right now. How do you translate that sense that common mores, common societal expectations, morality, factor into statute interpretation, actual words of this statute? The word that we're talking about here, mixture, how does that play? Because you need to translate, you need to make it real.
Well, I guess someone who was reading the statute, how would they interpret it, and how would they know what they would be comfortable for?
What the ordinary man on the street, or woman?
Well,
you're not helping your argument. Okay, let's keep going.
And so I don't think someone who read the statute would necessarily see it as applying to them.
Okay, and here the word that you mentioned previously comes back into play, carrier.
Yes.
Carrier, not because Congress meant to say carrier and that's what the word really means in the statute. What the word mixture means is defined by the fact that there's another word out there, carrier, that they didn't use. So therefore, mixture must have a narrower meaning than what carrier is. They meant to exclude this. Am I correct?
Yeah.
This is a judge helping you during oral argument. It does happen eventually. All right. So anything else you'd add at this point before I turn to my distinguished panel and the rest of the room to ask for their vote on this case? You're all set. Okay. Because I think I saw a hand go up from at least one judge who wants to vote early. Yes?
Oh, no, I wanted to bring up the for Anya. Like, there's a bit in here where they...
Your co-counsel was just to speak.
about the pancake syrup. You know, syrup mixes with pancake, and it's, like, entwined, and you can't separate the syrup from pancake. Mm-hmm. But nobody calls it a pancake syrup mixture. They call it pancakes with syrup. So
I should warn you, I haven't had breakfast. This is making it really hungry. Okay. But I have to caution you, that's not in the opinion. That's,
right.
That's Professor Solomon that notes afterwards.
Right. But I think it's a good point because it brings up a sort of objection to the intuition that nature implies as a very particular meaning that everybody agrees to. And in fact, we use mixture in many different ways to refer to different things. And we also mix things together that we don't call mixtures. So I think that's like, they take a very particular view of what mixture means when in ordinary and, you know, common usage together, we don't all have that same.
All right, the court recognizes your fellow co-counsel as well. I assume you're arguing for this position, not for the United States.
Yes.
Okay.
And I mean, assuming that Easterbrook, like, Easterbrook cares a lot about words, he's a textualist, assuming we do go by his definition, I don't know that Easterbrook would actually want to own those words if we take them to, if we take a textualist approach to his opinion, because if I take, you know, one dose of LSD and I go to the fountain over there with the cougars and I drop it in and then I'm like, slurp, slurp, kids, there's LSD, it's a mixture.
I'm amazed your imagination took you to that dark place. Let's keep going.
But I mean, that by Easterbrook's definition, you know, would make that person subject to a lot of prison time, and I don't think Easterbrook even had that intent or contemplated that when he wrote these words. You have to take context into consideration just reading his own opinion. So
maybe. I don't know Frank Easterbrook. I will simply say, though, his words and the opinion are pretty straightforward. Quote, mixture containing a detectable quantity, close quote, is not ambiguous. It means what it says.
And so he owns it. So doing that to the fountain, you know, puts you in prison for a very long time.
And I have to say, my moral intuitions are not necessarily offended by the thought that someone who dumps LSD into the Cougar Fountain and invites everyone to take a swim maybe should go to jail for a long time.
Probably not for the higher penalties, maybe because of
that. I'm not so sure about that.
Yeah.
Hey?
Okay.
Yeah.
It is a sacred.
But I hear you. Okay. So I'm going to pause here very quickly. Time's running. I'm sorry. One last comment. Are you co-counsel or are you judge at this point?
I'd like to help my co-counsel representing the government.
Oh, there you go.
She's getting ganked up on a little bit. The cocaine clause in the statute has the same wording as the LSD clause, and by the defendant's reading of it, we would punish defendants differently based on how pure their cocaine was.
Okay, why does that affect the interpretation of the statute? It poses some pragmatic difficulties, practical difficulties.
Because if, for instance, it is cocaine, we shouldn't have to test it to see how potent it is. Just the fact that it is cocaine, period, it should all be applied to the weight.
All right, so if I have, out of curiosity, you know that every single person in this room, if you pull a dollar bill out of your pocket and test it, there's detectable amounts of cocaine on it. It's become that entrained into the commerce, the dollar commerce in the United States, at very, very, very low levels. So are you simply saying that I am subject to potential penalties because I'm carrying a wad of $10 bills in my pocket that have detectable cocaine?
Definitely not, but we don't refer to those as cocaine, we refer to them as dollar bills.
Congress says an indetectable amount. That's black and white, counsel, according to what you're telling me.
It is true. But I guess in that sense, the cocaine could be separated from the dollar bills. I mean, I'm not a scientist.
By laundering them?
But,
sorry, I couldn't resist.
But with cocaine being cut by some other white substance, it's really hard to separate it, just like it is with LSD sheets and actual LSD.
So it's frequent to ship cocaine and crates of coffee. The scent of the coffee masks this odor of the cocaine from dogs instead of the porter. The coffee is usually surrounding the cocaine in a mix. That the coffee may weigh literally hundreds of pounds, and it's around maybe a kilo of cocaine. I have to measure the entire contents of the crate.
No, because assuming that I'm mixing the coffee grind with the cocaine, which is nasty, if I'm putting,
as long as it's wrapped inside, it's just the cocaine.
Right, right.
So if I mix it, I'm in bigger trouble. They count.
So that's what you're selling, cocaine mixed with the coffee? Yeah, I guess so.
It gets worse. Some cartels were actually manufacturing car components out of a type of plastic that incorporates heroin that they extract once it gets back across the border. If I take the trunk and fenders off my car and they contain detectable heroin, is your position that I have to measure the weight of my car?
Well, no, because if you are ingesting the heroin or whatever drug is being...
So if I chew my bumper?
Plastic, okay. You're not going to ingest the whole front bumper. But just separated from it. So in an instance where I sell a bag of cocaine that's mixed with some other agent, and that agent plus the cocaine is supposed to be ingested, yeah, I think the whole thing should be.
Fair enough, but I have to stop because the imagery here is getting really bizarre. Picturing someone sitting on the street sucking on the bumper of their car. Okay. Let's pause. Every oral argument must come to an end, even though the strands are not fully developed. Very quickly, just go with your gut. Don't agonize over this. I want everyone to vote. Quick show of hands. How many of you think Stanley should do hard time under the minimum mandatory that the government's urging here? All right. How many of you think that this is a ridiculous interpretation? Interesting. So about one quarter to three quarters. Just so you'll know, benchmarking, prior classes, I've seen it go as much as only one or two hands go up in favor of the government. So we clearly have a bit more of a law and order class this time this round. Absolutely. Thank you so much. Capable, wonderful jobs. I appreciate both of you. I never gave you your slack for doing your work on it. So this, again, has nothing to do with the drug theme, but this is a kaleidoscope. All right. Time's running short, guys, so let's try to distill this down. Crystallize it. I'm using all sorts of drug metaphors today. What's the point? First of all, Easterbrook. Take a look at that. That's not a bad case for a demonstration of textualism in its purest form. You go with what the statute says, even if it means, you know, some poor guy who looks like he belongs in a Cheech and Chong movie is going to be doing hard time, or sorry, going to White Castle. Anyway, doing long, hard time, because that's what the statute says. Congress needs to fix it, but you can't necessarily monkey with it just because you think it doesn't feel right. Posner, on the other hand, and this is a pretty influential and growing philosophy among the federal bench, says, wait a minute, we're judges. We're not employees of the legislature. We are empowered, when we are faced with multiple interpretations of the statute, to draw on our notions of what is the societal norms and morals of the time we live in now, interpreting languages on the books. And that we're also given the flexibility and freedom to choose among multiple tools to get us to the interpretation that works, given that background. It's much less doctrinaire. That's why it's called pragmatic. It doesn't use the lodestar of one particular principle that guides the rest of the interpretation, no matter what. It picks and chooses and mixes and matches and assembles the right interpretation that matches the overall circumstances of the case. Now, I'll pause here. I gotta be honest with you. That kind of appeals to me, doesn't it? I'm perfectly happy to sort of say, you know, it may not be pure, but it gets to the right place we want to go. But I pose to you a couple of hypotheticals. Doesn't that approach give the judge enormous power? Who knows what societal mores are? Who knows whether or not there's a underlying norm that must be adhered to, what's moral? I invite you to consider, and this is a real possibility, United States Justice Ted Cruz. Man was Solicitor General, man Harvard Law School, Harvard Law Review, widely acknowledged to be extremely smart. He's going to bring a different set of societal norms and consider moral principles than you would find with Merrick Garland. I'm going on a limb here, but I think that's true, right? Think about a philosophy you may like of pragmatism in the hands of someone that you don't agree with. And that's the true test. That's what law is about, being able to cabinet constrain where it goes, even in the hands of someone that you may not agree with, and feel that it reaches a result you can still uphold. Number two, and this is the second hypothetical, where do you find these morals and norms other than the judge's subconscious? Is there a fair place you could look? Picture, if you will, and I've seen this, expert witnesses to talk about principles of morality, theologians. Now, not because those are legal principles, but because they are context for other legally relevant facts, such as whether or not someone is invoking the necessity defense, that they were forced to take action, even though it violated the law, in order to protect someone else's life. And if that life happens to be unborn, bringing in a theologian to talk about what the moral norms are is a relevant legal fact. Are there other places? What can you rely on? What's considered to be an authoritative source? I'll be honest with you here, it pains me to say this, I don't think I have an answer for you on those. But if you're going to be someone who is willing to follow pragmatism to where it goes, that's a question you have to consider, because that's the backdrop against which these pragmatic decisions get made. Mike.
System of, you know, I think
analysis of it, or we're not really evaluating it. We're not trying to make value judgments. We're trying to figure out what's going to happen if we do this. And when, it's not really like whether the result is what we think should happen. It's more like whether the result makes sense given the context of being a judge in the street.
That is law review caliber types of questions. I'll be honest with you, it's above my pay grade, because what you really can say, if I understand you correctly, is law is inherently about process, morality is inherently about outcomes, and how the two match are not necessarily dictated the same way every time. And I'll simply note, yeah, I hear you, but I don't think you can evade the fact that if your process relies on making a moral judgment, you're still ultimately integrating morality and societal norms into what's facially a neutral process.
I mean, but aren't you always doing that, whether you're doing contextualist analysis or not? Yeah. You're taking certain sorts of...
No, I hear you again. But that's sort of the third bottle of wine level of question at this point. Okay? So with that, I want to make sure any questions about how pragmatism as an alternative to our competing schools of textualism and purpose-driven interpretation stacks up. Let me offer one final thought, and then perhaps I want to do a quick tool for you guys to think about before we come back next week. Final thought here is effectively, it's sort of a pointer, really. If you're quoting principles to a judge in a case, you are not going to get a whole lot of traction from most judges by saying, this is the leading pragmatic-driven interpretation of statute. Judges generally are not going to do that as a binding school of thought. It may have some appeal, it may need some persuasion, but as opposed to a textual approach, or even if you need to invoke the purpose of the statute, those have much more traction than judges. So use pragmatism with caution. I offer it to you as an alternative school. It's one that is getting some adherence. It's sort of the inevitable reaction to the pure textualism that we've been seeing in the past decades. But nonetheless, you're always better off to start with the text, and frankly, purpose is going to get you more with most judges than saying this is a pragmatist approach. Then tool, and this is something I want to invite you all to think about. We gave you, in addition to the case today, some law professor readings. And I'm curious, what was your reaction to the funnel of abstraction? How many of you thought of Monty Python? There you go. Princess Bride. Harry Potter. The funnel of abstraction is just class diagonality. All right. I admit, it sounds a little bit easy to make fun. But I wanted to let you know, don't discard it. Don't discount it entirely. I'd suggest take pieces of it for you that are useful. And here's how I actually think about it. Again, this is not binding. This is not stuff that you have to answer this way in the final. It's just something I use that helps me. Rather than a funnel, I tend to think of a spectrum. And here, the one end is literal. Other end here is abstract. Offhand, quick, lightning round. First person to answer has the last bit of micro swag. What's the most literal of all the schools we've talked about so far? Is that enough?
New textualism.
Does he get it, guys?
Yes.
No? My God, what's happened to you? It's not much. I found this at the bottom of a sock. Which is, given the fact we're talking about text, appropriate that you could get a little book written in very literal terms. What?
No.
You're saying Thomas the Tank Engine is abstract?
No.
There's a whole deeper meaning I'm not aware of. Yeah. All right, moving along. What's next? What's the... If you've got new textualism here, what's something that's not quite so literal here? Sorry?
Text just based on textualism.
Well, or think of TVA versus Hill. How is that?
Is that your meaning or something?
Sorry, you're getting, no, you're getting there, but.
Soft it,
thank you, Chad. Say it louder, say it prouder.
Soft textualism.
Okay. All right. What the hell is soft textualism?
It's textualism, but you also look at the legislative history and stuff to kind of support yourself.
So basically, it's talking to yourself to convince yourself you're right.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. What's in the middle? Kind of getting there. Can I take that legislative intent and mutate it a little bit and say legislative purpose? All right. All right, I'm going to cheat. I have a terrible time saying purposivism, especially three times in a row. I challenge you guys to do it. Not now. I'm just going to say purpose-driven. Okay? By the way, I might also add here, somewhere in between, we could also talk about, just as tools, statutory history versus legislative history. Where you looked at a text, but also how the text evolves over time until you get a discernment from there without having to go to congressional reports. I'm sorry, go ahead.
A quick question. So purpose-driven and purposivism is the same thing?
Yeah, I just made that up. They're labels of the same. Purposivism and purpose-driven. I just, purpose-driven is a lot easier to say for me. Okay? I just want to make sure.
All right. Yeah, no, no.
Okay.
All right, clearly the fact that I've got more on the spectrum on the other side thinks that I'm inclined to find other things that go even more abstract. And here, there's no right or wrong. You disagree with what you throw out there. I've actually had the spectrum turn out different ways. I'm just talking before I get rolling on.
Consequences.
Mindset of consequences. What do you mean?
If we interpret it this way, what is going to be the effect?
All right.
Of this interpretation. So, for example, in that case with the throws, like we interpret it as a picture, that guy's going to go to jail for a long time. Is that an outcome?
All right, so what's another label for this school of thought, given what Judge Posner wrote about?
Oh, pragmatism.
Pragmatism, fair enough. Would y'all agree that pragmatism might fit right here?
Yeah.
Okay. I hear objections, Scott.
Can we put on the top of your spectrum the abstract funnel of abstraction terms that were used?
Absolutely. My suggestion, they're really catching the same concepts. The funnel is designed to give the sense that literal text is very narrow, but as you start looking at purpose, it gets broader and broader. So the funnel is designed to sort of this sense of opening up.
No, I get that.
But this is the same thing.
It's just starting to get gray for me where, like, in the funnel of abstraction in the book, the terms that were used were like the plain meaning of the text.
Absolutely. So you
it's
can.
It's just becoming great for me where exactly each of those terms fit with what.
Here's my suggestion. Let me add the last thing over here.
Sorry, guys.
No, that's all right. I think it's a very good point. What would go here is the far outlier. What's the one case everyone quotes when the law is against them and the facts are against them?
Holy
Trinity. Holy Trinity.
Okay.
All right. It sounds like something Robin says in a crisis.
Holy Trinity, Batman. Anyway. Kyra, back to your point. Look at the funnel, which actually talks about specific tools and documents. And on top of the spectrum, in the top half, you could actually, this is at the bottom of the funnel. This is at the top of the funnel.
No, I get
that. So you just map them all along here.
That's what I'm trying to do. It's just not clear to me where pragmatism fits, like with which of those. Is it okay that it's gray? Is it fine that
sure.
If it's in between and it doesn't have to be so concrete with one or the other?
There is, absolutely. This is not black letter law. I've gotten a different spectrum in other classes. You know, sometimes people switch these around. My point is, this is a way for you guys to have a tool to think about them so you can reach right answers.
Right,
it
makes me right.
I'm sorry, I'd be a little louder. The natives are getting restless.
I thought it was interesting that Posner allied natural law theory and pragmatism as over against positivism. But I can see how they're each distinct from positivism. But would you say that natural law theory is something abstracted as well? And if so,
I have an answer for you that is not an answer. I've always wanted to teach jurisprudence and natural law as a course here.
No one, however, is convinced that anyone will sign up for it.
I would sign up for it.
Okay. The other thing is I would have changed it after this class, but the password on my UH account is Aquinas. So that might give you a sense of my perspective on it. Okay. Anyway, so I know that doesn't answer your question, but natural law, I think, is using a much looser, not rigorous sense.
Right. Yeah, I think it's interesting that the natural law course then also calculus. So it kind of like makes it into a circle.
Okay. So with that, time is up. I see people putting on coats. Students' fans are waning. So over the weekend, next Tuesday, we're actually going to start going through the canons. This is the moment where I might be lecturing a little bit more than I like, but it's also the point where you're going to start getting the specific phrases and Latin canons that you're going to be using interpreting statutes. And then Thursday, we're going to have the judges. So with that, have a great weekend. I will see everyone next week.